It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret here with Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about the results from yesterday's primary elections in Wisconsin. First, this week has seen a lot of coverage of Robin Williams' death by suicide. Our next guest says it's important to look at how this story and other suicides get reported on, in part so that the coverage doesn't ultimately lead to more suicide down the road. Madeline Gould is with us now. She's professor of epidemiology in psychiatry and deputy director of research training in child psychiatry at the Columbia University Medical Center. She participated in a CDC workshop on suicide contagion and the reporting of suicide. Madeline, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, as I just said, one of the main worries is whether the media coverage of suicide can promote more suicide. Is there research on that? Can that happen?
There is abundant research that has shown that reporting of celebrity suicides in particular has a really a big impact. It's repeatedly been found to be followed by increases in deaths by suicide, which is why I'm so glad that you have invited me, because I really want to share the concerns that those of us who have been really attempting to prevent suicide for decades, need to share with the public. And that in light of Robin Williams being universally beloved and really an inspiration to so many of us, including me, because I'm really quite heartbroken, that it's someone like that who, if his death by suicide is covered in a way that might glamorize the death or sensationalize the death or normalize the suicide, that that's apt to impact on, other vulnerable folks who, might be struggling with similar problems, such as depression, or addictions.
So what kinds of coverage have we seen over the years that does what you just said, that might glamorize or romanticize or even normalize suicide? What are some of the wrong steps we take in the media?
Yeah, well, some of them in certain ways can't be avoided when someone is so well known. But one of the things is just having a lot of coverage, that repeated coverage, front page stories, headlines that say suicide have been shown to be factors that will have a greater impact. Now, in the case of someone so notable, so well known as Robin Williams, that really almost can't be avoided. But things that can be avoided and unfortunately have not been avoided have been presenting and talking about detailed descriptions of the method of his suicide. Many recommendations for safe reporting on suicide, one of the first recommendations are to avoid these detailed descriptions and that you don't want to give specifics of the method and the location, because people who, again, have been perhaps struggling with thoughts about suicide, struggling with different psychological problems that might lead to suicide, are more apt to imitate the actual method as well if they learn about it.
So that's so sad. The coverage could be almost a how-to or creating a mental picture for people.
Exactly. And that by having that mental picture, it also can prime their thoughts so that in addition to perhaps activating thoughts about suicide sort of more, generally, they can now focus on a very specific method. And that can then be a source of rumination or, just continual thoughts about it. And it's something that we really worry about. And that could have been avoided. You couldn't avoid sharing with the public that Robin Williams had died by suicide, because we need to raise the awareness that suicide is a problem. It's a problem, internationally, not just in our country. But we want to focus on ways to prevent suicide. And by you know, presenting a how-to die by suicide in a, you know, in a very lethal means and readily available means is really doing a disservice to all the vulnerable people out there who, you know, people want to stay alive. They may be struggling with this, you know, approach avoidance, a conflict that they have with suicide, and that we don't want to do anything that will, you know, increase the likelihood that they'll engage in a behavior that can actually kill them.
Another issue I wanted to bring up is the idea that reporting maybe in a wrong way can promote misconceptions about suicide. And what I'm thinking about in what I've read is that sometimes we talk about suicide in the media and elsewhere as this consciously thought out decision. You're weighing the pros and the cons, and that's not really how it works, is it?
Not at all. Suicidal behavior is not, does not reflect a rational act. It's not as if someone is, as you say, having the, you know, the pros and cons and making a list of, you know, why are they, you know, why they should or should not kill themselves. That they are in a state of, you know, really altered, you know, cognition, where they may have what's called tunnel vision, where you can only think of suicide as a solution to your problems. And that when we've talked to people who have been very seriously suicidal, and they clearly have many options, including treatment, including talking to, you know, family members, people in their social networks, trying to get distracted, trying to enhance their own coping strategies. There's so many steps that someone can take to try to get themselves out of a crisis. But when you are in that state of mind, and again, not a rational state of mind, you have blinders on. And the only way out that you can see is by killing yourself. So this is absolutely a misconception that someone has made a, you know, a rational decision that, you know, killing themselves is something, you know, that has many benefits compared to the, you know, the costs involved. Again, it's not a rational decision that people make.
One thing that's changed since that CDC workshop I mentioned earlier is the rise of social media. In some respects, we're all the media now. And one image that has come out this week is a picture of the genie, voiced by Robin Williams in Aladdin, with the caption, "Genie, you're free." What's wrong with that? What message is that promoting?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's something that I wanted to bring up as well. By presenting an image that someone who's died by suicide has now solved his problems or her problems and is now free and is out of pain and is in a better place, inadvertently gives the message to other vulnerable people that you too can be out of, you know, you too can be free. You too can solve your problems and be in a better place. And that is certainly not the message that we need to give to folks who are struggling with their own, you know, really severe depressive symptoms and their thoughts about killing themselves. The messages that we want to share is, what a tragedy. What a tragic waste of a wonderful life. What we want to share is, this is a problem that others can help you with. You may not realize it, but you can be helped. There are treatments for depression. There, you know, but it's still a struggle. I'm not going to say it's easy, but that there is help. There are options, and that you are not free. What you are is now over. You have ended any chances that you might have to, you know, to contribute to other people's lives, to have a meaningful life of your own in the future. And that we know from interviews of individuals who have jumped off of, I won't say what bridge, but, you know, prominent bridge in the United States and have miraculously survived, what they'll tell us is that as soon as they stepped off, as soon as they jumped off of a bridge, they are sorry that they've done that. They realize, oh, what have I done? they realize the mistake that they've made. So acting on your suicidal thoughts, dying certainly by your suicide, is not free. That given these, you know, quote, near misses, these folks are so glad to have survived their suicide attempt. They are so willing to share their stories with other people because they don't want other people to make what has turned out to be such a terrible, terrible mistake. That's the message. It's such a waste of a life, and certainly it's not something that people should be emulating because they'll be free. There are other ways, there are other options to solve your problems.
Madeline Gould is with us. She's an epidemiologist and suicide researcher. We're talking about how suicide is covered in the media, how we talk about it in the media, in social media, and maybe to our families, too, after the death this week of Robin Williams. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What have you seen in media coverage of suicides, high profile or otherwise? Is there something that just sounded wrong to you? How do you think we should talk about it? In the news, on social media? How do you talk to your kids when these stories are out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. We're talking about suicide and the way we talk about it in the media, with our kids, on social media, following all the reporting of Robin Williams' passing. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Madeline Gould is with us. She has been researching suicide for quite some time now, worked with the CDC on a workshop on media coverage of suicide. Madeline, before we go to our callers, I wanted to talk about the shoulds. We've been talking a lot about the shoulds. What is a positive way for, say, a reporter, a news producer, to confront these issues?
The first should is to share resources with audience and readers and so on, so that folks who are troubled with their, you know, own depression or other problems, or of a, you know, of a friend or a family member, that they'll know how to reach out. So for the past 15 years, we've been evaluating the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline's 1-800 number in the United States. That's available 24/7, and I'd like to share that with your audience. It's 1-800-273-TALK, which is 1-800-273-8255. By calling that number, folks can get resources for people that they're worried about, so that in your community, they'll give you numbers of community mental health centers, you know, and so on. If someone in the middle of the night is having a crisis, you can call. And we know that these services work. They save people's lives. And so they're able to, you know, really work with someone so that you can try to, you know, decrease that agitated state that you might be feeling. So that's absolutely a do, you know, something that we would recommend, to include referral phone numbers or information, you know, as I say, about either local or national crisis intervention services. Another do is to give a realistic image of the causes of suicide, as well as the recent treatment advances. And so one of the things that is so important for the public to know is that suicide is preventable. It's not inevitable. You know, it seems as if it's inevitable when you have someone as beloved as, you know, Robin Williams, who has succumbed to, you know, whether it's depression or addiction or whatever problems he was having. But, you know, we really want people to recognize that, you know, there have been treatment advances, and although people may succumb to the stigma of going to a mental health professional, we would hope that, you know, in light of someone's suicide, that they would really recognize the importance of getting treatment for themselves or for their, you know, children or their spouses or their, you know, or their parents. So those are two do's, you know, provide resources, emphasize, you know, recent treatment advances, and not to simplify the risks or the causes of suicide. And that even though someone is prominent, you know, as Robin Williams is, that hopefully won't, you know, hopefully won't influence other folks. But even what we call suicide contagion is one, you know, is one influence. And that even if the publicity around someone's suicide does contribute to someone's, you know, contemplation or someone's actual acts about suicide, it invariably does so in combination with many other suicide risk factors. So we never want to see a message that just says, you know, someone was bullied to death or bully side, which we've seen, you know, which I'm not saying that bullying doesn't have, you know, play a role, but it's never just one thing. It really is a constellation of, you know, several things that will play into someone's death. And again, to, as you were trying to do, debunk myths in that, you know, suicide is not a rational act. It really is the result of an untreated or undertreated, you know, psychiatric illness. And luckily, suicidal, you know, deaths by suicide are rare. Many people think about suicide, but few people actually act on those thoughts or die by suicide, luckily. So I think that people need to be aware that it's a dreadful cause of death, and it hurts, I mean, so many people in terms of just the enhanced grief. But nevertheless, it is luckily rare, and that with regard to, you know, ways to talk about it, parents and family members and friends really need to get over their fear of asking someone if they're thinking of killing themselves. If you're worried about someone, do it. Go ask them, because asking them is not going to put ideas into their heads. We did research, you know, others have shown you can ask people if they're thinking of killing themselves. And it's something that, you know, is uncomfortable, but we need to get people more comfortable in just being very direct and asking someone that, you know, I see that you really seem to be in so much pain or things so bad that you're thinking of killing yourself.
I want to bring a caller in, Madeline. We've got Paul on the line in Chippewa Falls. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a religious leader and have walked with families on occasion, fortunately not very often in my almost 20 years doing this, but there have been a few times, and one of the things I've noticed when wanting to address depression forthright is really strongly encouraging families when a loved one does take their own life to be upfront about it. In the media so often we see it mentioned, you know, died unexpectedly, things like that, and I think it would be so much more helpful for our society to address these concerns forthright if we could somehow in a tasteful manner say, you know, this person took their own life. And just I'm interested in your comments with regard to that.
Paul, thanks for that. Madeline, just a minute or so left.
Yes. Paul, I agree with your suggestion. And given your position as a religious leader, I'm sure you've been, as you say, involved in some very sensitive situations. I think that we shouldn't hide the fact that someone in our family or friend has died by suicide. It's the only way that we're going to raise awareness and then put the resources that are needed for, you know, enhancing suicide prevention and interventions into communities. And to decrease the stigma attached to suicide prevention. You know, clearly we don't want to encourage people to die by suicide, but if we don't raise awareness. If we don't try to reduce the stigma of reaching out and getting help for your, you know, for your depression and other problems, then we're never going to be able to, you know, to lick, you know, this very serious problem. So I agree with Paul that, you know, we need to be forthright so that people, when they are feeling suicidal, don't feel so ashamed and isolated that they don't ask others for help.
Madeline, we're just about out of time. Can you give us that number for people to call for help if they're
Yes. It's 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. And that's the number from the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And when you call from your community, you'll get a crisis counselor from, you know, your general community so that he or she will be familiar with the resources that are available to you.
Madeline, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you for inviting me. Thanks.
That was Madeline Gould. She's a longtime researcher in issues of suicide. She's with the Columbia University Medical Center. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
First, Wisconsinites headed to the polls yesterday to vote in a variety of primary elections. The winners will head to the general elections in November.
By and large, the results came back as expected, but there was a surprise or two.
Here with us to break down the results is Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee. Mordecai, welcome back.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, one of the races we thought we wouldn't have to talk about too much looked like it was a done deal. The GOP primary in the 6th Congressional District, it was called for candidate Glenn Grothman, then uncalled. What's going on there?
Well, you know, sometimes we have expectations about precision of vote counting that really aren't quite as reasonable because it's an old, almost 19th century process. Where some, they have to hand count the absentee ballots, they have to call it into the clerk, the clerk has to write it down. You know, I'm trying to get everybody to visualize that this is a very old-fashioned process. So the fact that on election night, we got the results very slowly and then that his lead started diminishing is, I think, just a reflection of how antiquated our election results reporting process is.
Well, and this has happened in a past Supreme Court election where the winner kind of flipped and flopped a little bit as we saw different areas coming in over the course of days.
Rob, I'm glad you're mentioning it because this is a problem across the board. It's not a problem for Democrats or Republicans or Fox Valley versus Waukesha County. Well, we really do have an antiquated infrastructure.
Do we have a sense of when we're going to know if it's Glenn Grothman or Joe Lipum in that district?
I think what's going to happen is that because it's so close, there's going to be a recount. And whether it's close enough, so it's an automatic recount, in other words, within 0.5%, or whether it's slightly beyond it, I'm pretty sure one of the two candidates will do it. And I once participated in a recount, and I can tell you it's a very slow process, but it's a very exacting process and a very reassuring one in terms of trust in government. They really do literally do it one at a time. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the lead changes or if the lead narrows. You know, some of your listeners might remember the recount up in Minnesota that Al Franken eventually won by, what was it, 23 votes, and they argued over every single one. So I think it's going to be a couple of weeks.
Well, turning to a county sheriff race. Now, county sheriff races don't usually get a lot of attention outside the borders of a county, sometimes not that much inside the borders of a county. Where you are now, the Milwaukee County Sheriff race got national attention. Why did it draw so much?
You know, it's so surprising. You remember when during the April election, the Koch brothers sided with and opposed some of the county board members up in, I think it was Douglas County or something like that, and people were saying, huh? You know, why is a national organization getting involved in a county board race? Well, the exact same thing happened here in Milwaukee County, and the reason I'm mentioning that earlier example is I think what we're seeing is the nationalizing of local elections. In other words, all of a sudden, every election, even for dog catcher, becomes a kind of a referendum on the partisan gridlock and the ideological gridlock in American politics. And so the sheriff of Milwaukee County is actually the least important sheriff in all the 72 counties in Wisconsin because Milwaukee County is the only county that doesn't have any unincorporated areas. And that means that the sheriff here has no sort of police department kind of activities. So he does the freeways and he does county facilities and bailiffs, and that's about it. But even though he's so minor in terms of policy, his views on gun control and on right versus left political ideology made this a kind of a referendum. And so it was an interesting race to watch, even though it seems to me, in terms of policy, a very unimportant one.
Right. The incumbent ended up winning there. Lots of money came in from the NRA, from Mayor Bloomberg's group opposed to or in favor of gun control. This is a seat that will have almost no say on gun control decisions.
You know, it's just astonishing how ideology can make an unimportant office seem important in terms of elections. And in fact, I'd go one step further. Why do we elect sheriffs? We don't elect police chiefs. But this is sort of another example of an antiquated 19th century habit that's carried over into the 21st.
Well, probably the most high-profile primary in statewide races was the attorney general race. We saw Jefferson County District Attorney Susan Happ win over Dane County DA Ishmael Azan and State Representative John Richards. A race where all three candidates were really, really similar in their positions on almost all issues. What do you think gave Susan Happ the edge there?
You know, this is an astonishing result. And in fact, you could almost say this is why we still hold elections. In other words, for all the pundits and for all the commentators who in advance predict elections, this one was totally unpredictable. And, you know, thank goodness for the Wisconsin voters for reminding us of that. And she really, I'd have to say, came out of nowhere and had such a commanding victory. It's just awesome in that respect. And another thing that I like about it, Rob, is that she was not necessarily the highest spender. You know, sometimes we start getting a bit lazy and we start thinking that the biggest spender in a contested election is always the winner. No, that's not always the case, and she's a good example of it. And you know, there were some minor policy differences between her and the other two Democratic candidates, for example, on gun control, on first offense for drunk driving. But I think here it was almost like a spontaneous a conference call by the Democratic voters in the primary who said, let's all coalesce behind her. And I think she's a fresh face, a new face, and I think this is good for the voters because it means that the November election between her and the Republican nominee is going to be a real election with two very competent and qualified candidates.
Moving on to the other big statewide race, the race for state treasurer, before we get to the governor's race now. But it's interesting in that we ended up, we talked to all the candidates here, we ended up with a Democrat who wants to restore duties to the office, a Republican who wants to get rid of the office completely.
You know, I think this is healthy because, in a sense, even though this is a minor office, there's a clear-cut choice. Voters who think it should stay in elected office get to vote for one of the candidates, and voters who think it should be abolished get to vote for the other. And I'll confess that I'm biased here. When I was in politics so long ago, I introduced a constitutional amendment to abolish both the state treasurer and the Secretary of State's office. It's almost like my comment about sheriffs. Why do we still do this? But it's very, very hard to abolish elected offices.
All right. Now let's get to what a lot of people are seeing as the main event here, the race for governor. Briefly, the primary, Democrat Mary Burke cruised by a substantial margin past Brett Halsey. Was this ever really in doubt?
I don't think this was in doubt, and this was probably, from the perspective of the Burke campaign, a kind of a shakedown cruise or a dry run to see how good their organization is. And if judging by the results, even though he ran a minor campaign, they're in pretty good shape, and the Democratic voters are behind her. I was a little surprised that she did not hold a kind of a victory party down in the Milwaukee or Madison area, so she could get on TV and get sort of the momentum one gets from winning a primary, no matter how sort of unimportant it was. After all, Governor Walker last night, having no primary, did a victory party and had a speech on TV. He got to give his message out to a million voters. So I was a bit perplexed by the political logic of her being up near Rhinelander and not being in the main media markets.
Well, now that the race has already in effect been Burke versus Walker. Now it truly is. Recently, national political pundit Larry Sabato from the University of Virginia called this one of the five most competitive races involving a sitting governor in the country. Headline news: the primary results in some papers Mordecai, what are you going to be watching for in the coming months in this race?
I think what I'd suggest we all watch for is who successfully defines the race. When we heard Governor Walker's victory speech last night, he was trying to define her. Will she be able to get out from under that? Will she be able to define the race as, let's say, a referendum on his promise of 250,000 jobs? That, I think, is going to be the result. And she's been pretty disciplined about not getting into ideological fights on emotional social issues. She's almost running as though her qualifications are, I'm not Scott Walker. We'll see who can prevail in this sort of public debate, who can be more persuasive. And here, money will make a difference. If he outspends her 2-1, that means we'll be seeing 2 commercials for every 1 she has.
Well, there's a lot of people in the state who'd vote for Darth Vader if he was on the right ticket. What about those that handful of undecided voters? How do they reach out to them?
Rob, I really love it that you're mentioning it, because there are about 6 to 8% of voters, likely voters, who claim that they're undecided in the governor's race. Now this is sort of an astonishing phenomenon. How could somebody not have an opinion about what's been happening since Act 10? You know, you wonder if they're off the grid, if they're living in the Stone Age. But you're right to focus on it, because if the race right now is 46-46 or 47-47, those 6 or 8% will determine the election. And I think what we're seeing is that both campaigns are sort of fishing for what will be the magnet that will attract these voters? What will budge them off of being in the middle of the road and undecided? And to a certain extent, that's the election. The secret to the undecided is the secret to winning the November election.
We'll be watching that between now and November. Mordecai, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee. It's time now for our weekly look inside Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. The U.S. military is back in action in Iraq, but how are the country's legislators responding?
And there were a few surprises in yesterday's primaries, but coming up next Tuesday, there's a primary in Alaska that'll play a role in deciding which party controls the Senate next year.
And while the Senate may be in play, a USA Today report out earlier this week lays out plenty of reasons that the House is pretty securely in Republican hands this fall. USA Today politics editor Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Rob. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Well, Congress seems to be pretty solidly in support of the airstrikes, at least the airstrikes, against ISIS in Iraq. Is it fair to say that Congress is actually more or less in agreement on something?
Maybe a little bit. It's what's interesting about the statements out of Congress is that they agree that the airstrikes are the right thing to do, and that's all they agree on, because there's sort of several schools of thought. There is the Republican camp that will tell you the airstrikes were the right thing to do, but it shouldn't have come to this if Obama had not withdrawn troops from Iraq. There's another camp that says the airstrikes are the right thing to do, but we need to do much more. We need to send more ground troops and really take back over the country. There's another group of Republicans that would tell you that the airstrikes are the right thing to do for humanitarian purposes, but we cannot under any circumstances get more American troops involved in Iraq. And then, of course, there's Democrats who say basically the same thing, that airstrikes were the right thing to do, but no open-ended military commitment is possible. We can't be involved in restarting the Iraq war. So, yes, I think there is broad agreement that this was a humanitarian crisis, that the United States needed to respond, and a military response was appropriate. Once you get past that, the disagreements break out into the open.
Do you expect to see any sort of cohesive positions developing anytime soon among Democrats and Republicans?
No. You know, what's interesting about that is that, first of all, Congress, of course, out of session, so they don't have much to do on this topic for a while. And the second thing is, it's not clear that Congress has any real authority to do anything anyhow. It's fairly clear that the administration has an authorization for military force in Iraq that continues to permit them to use military force without the approval of Congress, particularly if there's no ground troops involved. At the moment, the administration says they don't need any more money, so they don't need Congress to approve that either. So there's nothing really forcing Congress to take action or to come to a consensus position. And honestly, I think to some degree, Congress would prefer to stay out of this. I don't think members of Congress have a good answer either, and so they're better off letting Obama struggle with this problem rather than inserting themselves into the middle of it.
So since they won't be directly involved out of session, maybe they don't need to do anything, is this going to give at least some members of Congress some latitude for electioneering around this issue?
Well, maybe, but again, it's hard to decide how this cuts, right? If you are a conservative Republican, you're running in a campaign, you can say, "See, Obama screwed up in Iraq." However, if it looks like we are running a successful humanitarian operation, rescuing tens of thousands of Yazidis from a isolated mountaintop where they face sheer starvation, maybe Obama looks good at that moment. You know, it's hard to figure out exactly what the political angle is here. I think, you know, the strongest political angle, honestly, is possibly the least popular one, which is there's a small group of liberals who are arguing no more war, get out of Iraq, no more bombing, let's walk away from it. Possibly also a small group of kind of isolationists on the conservative side as well. Maybe they argue this is a good campaign piece for them because they can say, you know, we're the ones who really are for peace. But I'm not sure that's going to move a whole lot of races.
And meanwhile, as you said, you've got President Obama sort of acting alone on the world stage.
Yeah.
If, say, things go spectacularly well, just, you know, for the sake of argument,
what are the odds of that?
is there any chance he could turn it into political capital and use it to swing some Democrats in the November elections?
Well, you know, I think any time there is a U.S. engagement in the world and the president is leading on the world stage, to the degree it works out well for the Americans, for American foreign policy, that, of course, makes the president and his party look good. And people will want to stand next to the president, or at least next to the president's policies, and say, this is what we did right. In this case, however, I have to say, without being sarcastic at all, it is hard to understand what exactly the good outcome would be that would make people want to stand there and say, we achieved something great in Iraq. It's very murky. Even a victory at this point, it's not clear what a victory is. I mean, the whole campaign is about freeing these people who are in jeopardy and you know, to some degree degrading the ability of ISIS to move across the nation. But, you know, that's a pretty narrow goal, and I'm not sure it's one you put on a campaign platform.
Well, moving on to primary elections, just had ours in Wisconsin. You told us last week, Paul, not a lot you're watching here in terms of control over Congress or the Senate. And, well, obviously not the Senate, no election here. But looking ahead, what races are you keeping an eye on in the next week or so?
Well, I do want to mention, though, I was eavesdropping in your conversation with Mordechai Lee, and that was really interesting when he talks about the fact that like 6 or 7% are the undecideds in the middle. When you think about that, and it matters for this conversation about who controls the Senate, you know, in a lot of these races we are talking about, the swing races, we're talking about, you know, 45 to 45, Republican to Democrat. They both have, you know, no one has a major lead. They're neck and neck. It means that in the middle there are these 5 or 6 or 7% of people who are, in theory, or in some ways, the least politically active and the least politically engaged. They don't really have strong opinions about politics. They're the ones who are going to make the decisions. It's really interesting when you think about it that way. The one I'm watching now is Alaska. We actually got a reporter going up there in a couple of days. There is an Alaska Senate race. Senator Mark Begich is a Democrat up for re-election. Alaska is a tough place for Democrats, always has been. And there was a Republican primary yesterday. Republican primary next Tuesday. And there is, again, this divide. There are a couple of candidates in the mix for Republicans, one a Tea Party candidate who is pretty divisive, one a sort of more establishment Republican who's being attacked by the Tea Party guys for being not from Alaska or not a, you know, real Alaskan. The Republicans are in danger of eating their own young here, having a brutal primary, and leaving Begich with a clearer path to re-election. That race could be one that really determines the tilt of the Senate in November.
So the Senate is in play, but USA Today published a report earlier this week saying that the House is pretty much a done deal in terms of going to the Republicans.
That's right.
How come?
Part of it is redistricting. At this point, members of the House have basically chosen their voters instead of the other way around. So there's very few districts that have any kind of swing in them. They are built to be safe Democratic and safe Republican districts. And then you've got, you know, 90-some-odd percent of the Congress are incumbents running in safe districts. There's about two dozen House seats that are really competitive, and in those cases, most of them are Democratic-held seats. There's only a handful of Republican-held seats that that the Democrats really have a chance to win. So we say there is no way they can get the 17-seat swing they need to take over the House of Representatives.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Have a great week, guys.
You too. That's Paul Singer. He's politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us each week at this time to bring us up to date on the latest from Congress and in election season, what's going on in the primaries and then the runoffs.